Hello and welcome once again to Radio Verulam 92.6 FM. You are with me, Jason McKenna, talking to your local politicians. And today's guest is MP Daisy Cooper. She's here to answer your questions. But remember, if you've not been lucky enough to get answers from Daisy this time, she will be back again next month to field those questions. But without further ado, let's get into those questions. So since we last spoke to you, Daisy, you've been in and around St Albans supporting local businesses. Does this put you in the mind frame that the city and the area is now well prepared as lockdown eases and things get back to more normality?
Yes and no. So in my conversations with local retail and hospitality owners, the message I'm getting is that in many cases, not all cases, but in many cases, footfall is up. People are returning, people are sort of spending their money and supporting our local businesses. Many of them obviously are still getting a lot of online trade as well, which is fantastic. I think it's probably too soon to say that there's complete confidence, particularly in the hospitality sector. I think we've discussed before this, this issue of the rent crisis, because many hospitality venues and retail for that matter haven't had any support with their rent. And as furlough comes to an end, rents are going to suddenly shoot right back up to sort of 80, 90 or 100% of what they were before. So I think even though the return of trade in many cases has been quite good, I think there's still quite a lot of anxiety about people's financial, about businesses' financial security in the longer term.
Did you have, on a personal level though, a favourite shop that you visited? I mean, one of the highlights, possibly the Lego store that you visited?
Yeah, that was just a little bit of fun. So after Lib Dems won the Cheshire and Amersham by-election last week, you will have seen in the newspapers over the weekend, there was a major photograph which was repeated time and time again, or used time and time again, of my party leader, Ed Davey, hitting down a literal blue wall with a little orange hammer. And it was such a fantastic image, very cheesy, but fantastic image that dominated the newspapers. I couldn't help just popping into Brick Traders on Catherine Street just to try and recreate it with some Lego. And it was quite fun. And Emma, who runs the shop, helped me find all the white bricks to recreate it. So a little bit daft, but quite a nice little visit to catch up with her as well.
Well, I mean, you've brought us nicely onto the topic that is dominating this month. And in terms of it, your party has had a massively positive June. There was a huge electoral victory, as you said there, in Chesham and Amersham, this by-election. This was one of the biggest seat swings of all time. Daisy, how was this done? And have you had a little bit of time to celebrate yet?
So it was done through sheer hard work. You know, as Liberal Democrats, we pride ourselves on our community work, on talking to people, on listening to people's views and trying to give them a strong voice in local government, but also in Parliament. And the overwhelming message that we got from people in Chesham and Amersham was simply that people just felt taken for granted. And I went over there a number of times to support our candidate, Sarah Green, who's now the new MP for Chesham and Amersham. And it was just amazing that people were saying to us, we've just never had anybody from any political party come and knock on our door. And of course, you know, that's quite different in St Albans. Liberal Democrats in particular here, we're very active and, you know, pride ourselves on knocking on doors and speaking to people. But that just hadn't, there was no history of that really in Chesham and Amersham as a true blue seat. And so when we turned up and asked them what they thought about things and what they were concerned about, people got a sense that we really cared. And they wanted to vote for Sarah as our Lib Dem candidate to give them that strong voice that they really deserve.
You actually helped, you know, on the ground level there with knocking on the doors there. Did any of the particular policies resonate with the area as well? Do you remember anybody kind of having a specific conversation with you about that?
There were lots of different issues that came up, to be honest. And I know that the Conservative Party are trying to frame this as a referendum on HS2, but that wasn't really the case. That there were some smaller villages that are very, very, very heavily affected by HS2. But in a lot of cases, people said, look, we know it's going ahead, but we don't like the fact that, you know, we're asking for information, it isn't being shared. We're not being consulted on all these big lorries that turn up outside our road without us being told about it, all this traffic and congestion, and we're asking questions about the impact on biodiversity and nobody's getting us answers. So I think people just felt as though they were being ignored and not listened to, and that, you know, even though this sort of plan was going ahead, they sort of felt as though they still couldn't ask questions about it. There was a lot of concern about this planning bill that the government's bringing forward. I'm deeply concerned about it. Under this new planning law, the government is trying to rip away the ability of communities to have any say whatsoever on where houses should be built, or where development should happen, what it should look like, how to keep it in keeping with the character of a place. And so we were absolutely clear that we want community-led development, not a developer free-for-all. But there were lots of other issues that people raised, you know, COVID spreading through care homes and the scandal around that, and just a lot of people generally feeling as though Boris Johnson just doesn't speak for them. They don't like his brand of conservatism. They don't like the fact that he's very right wing, and they feel as though he doesn't really share their values anymore. And the Liberal Democrats seem to be the closest fit for those kind of previous conservative voters who are internationalists, they're environmentalists. They might prefer to have a smaller state, but they still, you know, can see the benefits of supporting business and having strong public services. And they just didn't feel as though the Conservatives really spoke to that set of values.
In this election, you were there at the count, but this time as deputy party leader. This is obviously vastly different to your experience 2 years ago at your election. I'm sure it was just as tense, though. I mean, how was your experience different being involved in this capacity than your own victory in St Albans? And was this victory just as good?
It was just as good, actually, because it's lovely to share in anybody's win, even if you're not the candidate. So it was just as good. I guess the difference was in 2019, it was a very different kind of campaign, because obviously it was before the pandemic. So it's a kind of more traditional election campaign in that you had big groups of people and you could all get together and all the rest of it. And it was very different this time round without that. In 2019, for my own election, as the candidate, you don't go to the count at the beginning. So as the candidate, you wait until somebody calls you and then invites you to sort of come to the count, as it were, and tells you that they're ready to announce. So obviously at 2019, I was sort of sitting at home, sort of biting my nails, waiting for the phone call for someone to say, right, you know, hop in the car and up you come to the Batchford sports centre. Whereas in this case, I went straight to the count at 10 o'clock and was sort of on media duty, as it were, for the party for a couple of hours. And I left just before Sarah arrived, actually. So, yeah, quite different.
Now, we do have to turn our attentions to a more sombre discussion there. And June 14th marks 4 years since the Grenfell disaster. But you are still continuing the campaign for those living in accommodation that has cladding that poses a similar threat. What hope can you give to residents after the government's recent proposals fell short of protecting all residents?
Well, I guess the short answer is, the hope I can give is that I'm not going to give up. I'm going to keep banging the drum in Parliament to say that this is deeply, deeply unfair. And as the weeks go on, you know, leaseholders in St Albans and across the country are receiving these eye-watering bills for 50, 60, 70, 80, £90,000 to remediate not just cladding but also other fire safety defects with their flats. And in some parts of the country, these bills are higher than the actual value of the flat in the first place. So it's, you know, it's really devastating, and it's creating a problem for people where they can't sleep at night because they're scared of living in a home that isn't safe. It's destroying their mental health and well-being. They can't move on with their lives, and potentially facing bankruptcy. It's an absolutely awful situation. So I guess there's two or three things that are happening. The first is there's this building safety fund which exists at the moment to support the taller buildings to remove their cladding. There are negotiations happening behind the scenes between the government and managing agents at the moment about how to make those contracts work, and I've been trying to find opportunities in Parliament to press the government on what it's doing to resolve that legal impasse at the moment. The second thing is that there is a second piece of legislation coming down the track called the Building Safety Bill. We have the Fire Safety Bill, which is the first piece of legislation. The Building Safety Bill is the second piece of legislation. So I'll do my very best to try and raise all the same issues again with that particular bill. And then the third thing, which I'm very pleased about, is that I have secured an opportunity to table my own piece of legislation. It's a private member's bill. It's called a 10-minute rule bill. And what that means is that I have 10 minutes to stand up in Parliament to set out the case for my piece of legislation. And what I'm calling for is an independent inquiry into the government's handling of this whole situation. Because as you said at the beginning, it's 4 years on now since Grenfell, and it's absolutely appalling that we still have people living in homes that are simply not safe.
Now, in the local area this month, you've been supporting Pride, and one of the events has been that you're especially proud to champion is the Pub Pride. Please tell us about this event and how people can get involved in July.
A number of venues in St Albans and across the country have signed up for Pub Pride. It's an event that has been started by the charity Ask for Clive, which is a St Albans based LGBT plus charity. And all the venues that sign up will get some sort of bunting and flags and all the rest of it. And it's going to be held on the 23rd of July, I think. Hopefully you can double check that date, but I think it's the 23rd of July. So it's going to be after, I think it's the first Friday after the easing of restrictions are expected on the 19th of July. So basically, I would encourage people to go online, find their local venue, and go out and support Pub Pride and to show their support for the LGBT plus community.
Now, this is great, obviously, supporting the LGBT plus community. But during this month, there's also discussions about faux pride. You know, a lot of companies come to the fore and say that they're supporting the LGBT plus community, but their business doesn't line up with their the values that they're espousing. What can be done to hold these companies more accountable?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think in this case, it's known as rainbow washing, which is where the companies use the Pride rainbow as part of their sort of PR and marketing to give out the impression that they are a welcoming environment and that they're supportive of the LGBT plus movement. But as you say, in many cases, they're not sort of actively supporting it. And that can be examples of, you know, clothes companies that maybe source their goods from countries where it's illegal to be gay, or where you can't get married, for example. So there's lots of examples like that. So in terms of what businesses can do, I mean, the first is a very obvious one, which is to make sure that they actually make a donation and provide financial support to LGBT plus charities and initiatives. And that's a very simple thing that businesses can do. The second thing is for them to actually do a health check on their own employment practices to make sure that there isn't discrimination in their workplace, and that all people, irrespective of their background or gender or sexuality, are supported equally in the workplace. And then the third thing is for them to look overall at their business model. And if they are doing business with or investing with, you know, companies and organizations that are in areas where LGBT rights are not respected or supported, then they need to really look very closely at those and work out how they want to use their position and leverage, whether they want to withdraw from those places or whether they want to use their influence and purchasing power to try and bring about change and support in those places as well. So three different ways I'd suggest that businesses can be more LGBT plus friendly and not just do a bit of rainbow washing.
Those seem to be useful tips there, Daisy. This month, we've also seen the football going on Euro 2020, but there has been deeply upsetting scenes of what happened to Christian Eriksen, and thankfully, he seems to be on the mend. But it has sparked discussions about the need for more defibrillators and people taking first aid courses. This is something that you backed to a letter in Parliament. What progress has been made on that?
Yeah, so we haven't had a response from the government yet on this. But as you say, I did support this letter. As I understand it, there had been a scheme established, I think, in the last couple of years for the FA to support smaller football clubs with getting defibrillators closer to the side of the pitch. And there doesn't appear to have been much progress on that. So I was very pleased to sign that letter calling for an update on what progress there has been, and also calling for more financial support so that it's actually possible for all clubs, whatever size they are, whatever their income, to be able to have a defibrillator, which is, you know, a piece of life-saving equipment, by the side of the pitch.
And with the Liberal Council now occupying St Albans City and looking after the area, will there be work with you and them to kind of make sure that there's as many public defibrillators in the city as possible?
Well, as you say, it's a district council matter, but I have spoken to the lead councillor who would be in charge of this, and I know that he's already speaking to officers to find out what more can be done. I think there is a defibrillator in Verulamium Park, but I think we could accept that we need to look at where they exist and whether there's more that can be done, but it's a district council matter, and as and when I have an update, I'll definitely share it.
Oh, well, that might be another incident of democracy in action when we talk to you, Daisy. Just on a personal level as well, I think I'll be considering this myself, but will you be taking a first aid course just after seeing such an event as that?
Yeah, so I've done first aid courses in the past, but I have to say mine is probably slightly out of date. So it has occurred to me that if I get the opportunity that I might try and get a refresher. So as I say, I have done them in the past and I was very sort of conscientious about doing them, but I haven't done one for quite a while. So I think it's definitely a good idea.
Yeah, I think going forward, it should be something that a lot of people kind of look into. It saves a life. It's a very easy thing to do as well. And they're quite fun, the events as well. Now, one last question before we get into the community questions. But fellow MP Bambos Charalambos tweeted a picture showing that he was a starlet icon when he was a young man. But this picture was from when he was 18. And on a more maybe personal level, maybe a more interesting one, I talked to him about his development of his political life from 18 to now. And so I'd like to ask you a similar question, Daisy. Would you say that your 18-year-old self will be proud of the journey that you've taken so far? And were you always motivated to get into politics?
Well, first of all, I want to see this photograph. I would love to see what photograph Bambos has shared from being 18 years old. There's not many photographs that I would share, I don't think, from being 18 years old. So you have to send me that link. Aside from that, yeah, I think my 18-year-old self would probably be quite sort of proud of where I am now. I've certainly sort of chilled out a little bit. I think, as a young woman, you have various sort of neuroses, and certainly I remember, 18 years old, I was in my first year at university already, and probably still wearing some hand-me-down clothes and feeling a bit intimidated by all these sort of rich people I met at university, and trying to make my way in the world by, holding down a couple of jobs whilst trying to do my law degree. I think I worked hard, but had to sort of find my way in the world like many young people do. So I feel very settled, right now in terms of where I am in life, and I'm very happy with that.
Well, it's interesting to see the political journey, and I will send you that picture off air as well in terms of Bambos. I think it's fantastic, but I'm not sure if many people will join in the trend as well. Very brave from Bambos there. So let's switch our attention to the discussions from the local community. As always with these discussions on Radio Verulam, we are here to help the local community, and we called for questions for you. So let's move the discussion onto what the people of our local area want to know. The first one, and Stephen has asked, what can we do to support all the St Albans residents who are now stuck in low-rise risk flats with a small amount of cladding who are unable to sell due to current interpretation of government guidance? And Stephen actually put in a lengthy email to me that they are one of these people that have been directly affected.
Yeah, well, all I would say to Stephen is if he hasn't already been in touch with me, please do email me about this, because I'm sending out some updates to those people who are affected. I mean, in short, what the government has done is it's created one scheme for people living in homes which are not fire safe, that are below 18 metres, and it's created a different scheme for those that are above 18 metres. There is no justification for that 18 metres. It's been sort of plucked out of the air. And the height of a building doesn't necessarily correlate with how dangerous the cladding and other fire safety defects actually are. So that in itself is problematic. There has been a scheme only after lots of lobbying by myself and other MPs. The government did announce a sort of loan scheme for these low-rise buildings that Stephen's clearly living in. And it's very problematic because what the government is trying to suggest is that rather than individuals taking on a loan would be attached to the building. And the problem with this is that if you are then trying to sell your apartment, you sell your flat, there is an extra bill attached to that. And it's very difficult for people to sell their flats because if somebody's comparing two flats, one that is fire safe and one that is not fire safe, they can see that not only is the flat not fire safe at the moment, but there's also additional money they're going to have to pay every single year to make it fire safe. And therefore people are facing potentially a huge loss when they're looking to sell their homes on and move out. So they're in a real catch 22. To answer the question directly, the government has not provided any more information on this scheme yet, and therefore I can't give any more information at the moment because it doesn't exist yet. But that is now the next phase, which is to ask the government to provide more information about how it's going to work. But the scheme that they set up is very problematic, and therefore it may take a little bit of time. But Stephen, please do email me, and I'll certainly let you know about the questions that I'm asking, and I can work with your managing agent as well to make sure that any questions that they're putting to the government are also getting answered.
I'll make sure to pass the information on to Stephen there, because Radio Verulam wants to help the community as well. Miranda has also highlighted a problem that she finds with the government, because she says that black lives, safety of women, food poverty, hungry children, trans rights, police brutality and many more are being overlooked, but football is being protected. Why does the government have their priorities all wrong? Miranda asks.
It's a good question. I think it's probably slightly a rhetorical question. I'd probably be very sympathetic to that particular sort of question. I mean, every different political party has its priorities. And as the MP for St Albans, I continue to bang the drum for the priorities of St Albans. And when people write to me about various issues, then I try and pick them up wherever I can. But I share her frustration that, you know, the government didn't act on free school meals initially. Hasn't taken the issues of race inequality seriously. And so I share many of her frustrations.
Nikki has kind of brought the conversation back to a local issue. And she says, what are the plans to improve the electric car charging network in St Albans? The area has a very limited facilities compared to other towns and cities.
Yeah, it's a great question. There has been an improvement, but I know that people want to see more. All I can do is suggest that you write to your district and county councillors and ask them what is happening. So I know that the district council has tried to get more charging points in place, but that does require the agreement of the county council, because the county council is responsible for highways. And obviously when you put in electric charging vehicle points, that can have an impact on things like the flow of traffic and where people can park and all that kind of thing. So I know that the district council is trying to find more places for electric for these charging points, but I think if she can write to her local councillor and also explain where she would like to see them as well, that's the best way of getting a decent update.
Suze has sent in a message, and there's quite a few messages actually that she kind of sent on to me from people in the area, almost like she was representing quite a group there. But a lot of people are worried in the London Colney area about the Tithanger estate, which will see about 6,000 homes being built there. The residents are worried about the hugely negative effect it will have on the area, spoiling the natural beauty, adding extra problems for local facilities that are stretched, and this is being done on green belt land. Daisy, how was this allowed?
So let me try and unpack this, because planning is a really complicated area. At the national level, the Conservative government has told every local authority how many homes it has to build. And so every local authority, you know, including across Hertfordshire, but everywhere in the country, has to build that number of homes. There's a tiny little bit of wriggle room in negotiation, but not a great deal. And so there are, you know, thousands of homes that every area has to build. Where, for example, I mean, in St Albans, you know, our district is about 98% green belt. And therefore, when we are told we have to build homes on the green belt, which we are told we have to do, then we have to do what's called a green belt review to see, well, how do you minimise the impact on the green belt, and which places are, you know, is it better to build you know, in site A or site B, and that's part of the process in identifying sites to build these homes. This particular site affecting Tittenhanger is, as I say, for 6,000 homes, but it's actually part of Hartsmere Borough Council. So it's not in the St Albans district area, it's in Hartsmere. And it's part of their sort of local plan, and it will have been a decision of Hartsmere Borough Council. And I'm really sympathetic to residents in London Coney, because not only are their proposals to develop homes in the area, but they're sort of outside of this borough, which means it's very difficult, even though it affects people in London Coney, the residents of London Coney don't get a direct say. And that's part of the problem with the planning system. If it was done at a higher level, where it was a coordinated approach across the county, then residents would have a much greater say. But this is the approach that the government's currently taking. So all I can say is, again, it's a decision of Hartsmere Borough Council, but our people are concerned about it. All I'd do is encourage them to write to their district councillors and ask their district councillors to be in touch with Hartsmere Borough Council, because it is possible for different councils to write to each other and make representations.
Would you say this is another incident, like you said, in the Hartsad last month, of ramming through the wrong kind of housing in the wrong places?
I'd need to look at the specific site and look at the details of this. But I think, you know, that there are so many problems. There are so many problems with the planning system, as I say, that, you know, St Albans district and Hartsmere district and lots of other districts will all be looking at the best places that they want to build. And there is a degree of cooperation, but one district can't veto what another district is proposing, and therefore there is often a propensity for different councils to build on the outskirts, which, you know, so it affects people across the border, as it were, because they don't have so much of a voice. So without sort of looking at the specifics, say it's very, very difficult for me to actually give a view on this, but it is a matter for, it's a district council matter, and district councillors in St Albans district will be able to make representations to Hartsmere.
Stacey has suggested that there should be free parking on Sundays in the city to bring people back and protect the high street. She's asking, do you agree with that idea?
So again, this is another district council matter. It's not one for me, but my understanding is, from something I saw, I think, in a press release, I think the district council had decided that there was a specific day or particular days at the weekend when they would reduce the parking fees or make it free parking in order to encourage people back in. Now, obviously, there's a balance here. In the long term, we want to encourage people to get to not use their cars and to walk and cycle into town, but in the short term, I imagine that this initiative has been taken, you know, in order to try and encourage people to get that confidence back, so they actually feel able to go into town for a short period of time to do a bit of shopping and support our local businesses. So there's clearly a trade-off here, but my understanding is that this is a short-term initiative that's happening to support local businesses. But in the longer term, obviously, the plan is to try and get people out of their cars and onto their bikes and onto their feet.
So a final question to you, Daisy, before we wrap up here. At the moment of recording, England are through to the last 16 of the Euros. Have you been enjoying the football so far, and where will you be watching that all-important showdown against Germany?
Well, we've got a sweepstake in my office between myself and my staff. I'm not quite sure who pulled the names out of the hat, but I've actually got England in the sweepstake. I've got England and North Macedonia and Spain. So I am watching those all very closely. So yeah, I'm looking forward to the game. I've got no plans as yet as to where I'm going to watch it, but I'm sure I won't be able to avoid it, I don't think.
I mean, can you reveal to us what the prize is if you win the sweepstake?
I think it's just bragging rights, to be honest. I'm not sure there's even a prize. I think it's just bragging rights for winning.
Oh, well, it still sounds very fun, and I'm glad that you're getting enjoyed with it. And I think it's kind of so buoyant and lifting the country at the moment. But as always, Daisy, thank you for your time today. And for those of you who didn't have their question answered, Daisy will be returning next month. But thank you for your time, as always.
Pleasure. Take care.